You are listening to Along the Line, brought to you by the Media Freedom Foundation.
Welcome to Along the Line. I am Dr. Nicholas Baham III. I am joined, as always, by my co-host and anti-fascist, Dr. Nolan Higdon. And, as always, our sound engineer, the great Janice Domingo.
J.D.
Today we explore American immigration policy and debates surrounding it. So, Nolan, let's get going. Tell us, what's going on, baby?
Another fun fact for you.
All right.
Only a quarter of the Sahara Desert is actually sandy.
Ooh.
I'll give you another one, too. Do you know the Sahara Desert is not the largest desert?
It's not?
No. The Antarctic Polar Desert covers the continent of Antarctica, about 5.5
polar
million miles.
I forgot about that.
I didn't even know that there was such a term as a polar desert.
It is deemed a desert because there's nothing there.
The more you know.
Wow. I didn't do that well in geography in college.
So other than that, I'm following the story here about these Texas police departments. They're apologizing after these photos emerge of officers on horseback leading a handcuffed black man.
Yeah, I saw the photo. It's brutal.
But the unions are saying, the police union is saying that they did nothing wrong, which I wonder if legally speaking that is true. And I think we always conflate these two things about legality, but also like the history, the trauma, the PTSD that goes with these sorts of images.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been following this story. I think this is one I recommend kind of everyone follows, because I think get deeper than the legal question or whether or not the police get fired. I think the question about sort of the legacy, why is this so offensive? Why does it get this reaction? I think that's a real kind of story and conversation worth having about this.
The history behind the shit. You can't deny the history behind it.
Yeah, so I don't know. I've been following that. And then I've been following all of our social media stuff, and I encourage you folks to come out there, like us, follow us, love us on social media. One click for you and the world for us. We're at Instagram, Along the Line Show, Twitter, at Along the Line Number 2. I'm at Nolan _ Higdon. Nick is at Dr. Dreadlocks, DocTorDreadlocks. Janice is at J_Nice44. Also want to encourage you to go back and listen to all of our previous shows at projectcentered.org/ATL or youtube.com/alongtheline. You can check out those shows. Got some great shows on busing and reparations and mass shootings. Putney Swope, a great Nix flicks on that. So check those out there, again, at youtube.com/alongtheline or projectcentered.org/ATL or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also want to encourage you to pick up some of our books. I just finished my book with Mickey Huff, United States of Distraction. It is out now. Nick has The Coltrane Church. Recommend you pick up a copy of that as well. And if you're an educator, those books are great for the classroom, and so is Along the Line. So I encourage you to do that. Now, today we are talking about immigration and the border, and we're continuing to cover these sort of topics that are up in the 2020 election and kind of giving you some context to go beneath the political talking points. And so let's talk about kind of the reality of immigration, so-called unauthorized immigration. It's actually been falling since 2005, every single year, quite sharply as well. So we had about 12.2 million unauthorized immigrants in 2005. It's dropped to about 10 million in 2017 when Trump took office. So Trump can't take credit for that. This decline's been going on for over a decade now. Mm-hmm. Now, the number of unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. workforce is also steadily declining at that same time, went from about 8 million to about 7 million.
Okay.
Seen a decline there as well. Their share of the labor force is also declining as well. So as the labor force shrinks, less and less people are working. About 5.4% of the labor force in 2005 was unauthorized immigrants. It's down to about 4.6% in 2017.
I mean, this was a point that Andrew Yang brought up in the last debate, the CNN debate, you know, where you could only speak for 15 seconds and you had to engage in fighting with someone. It was a brutal debate, by the way. But Yang pointed out that as far as immigration is concerned, you're not losing your jobs to immigrants. You're losing your jobs to machines.
Yeah, and he tries to make that case. I mean, that's a great point. Even these states that are, you know, first of all, unauthorized immigrants only are going to about 17 states in total where there's any sort of number. But the interesting part, in 14 of those 17 states, the number has been dramatically declining. So California out here, right, we have a negative 775,000 immigration happening in the past decade. So the number of immigrants in our state are actually unauthorized immigrants, I should say, is going down. The only one that, you know, has seen really sort of large increases are places like New York or Boston, where you see about plus 60,000 over the last decade. Louisiana is plus 15,000.
Mm-hmm. They're advertising, by the way. Businesses are advertising.
For immigration?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like one of the things that we don't talk about a lot, especially because we've got people like Lindsey Graham in places like South Carolina, so we don't talk about Mexican immigration to South Carolina. It's not a border state, so we don't talk about it. But corporations have been long advertising for Mexican labor in South Carolina. For any of our listeners who have ever been to South Carolina recently, you know that there are now significant Latinx populations in centers like Columbia in South Carolina because of this advertising.
Yeah, and so it's increased in places like North Dakota and South Dakota in the last decade by like 5,000. But again, all these states that are so freaked out about immigration is going down. In Florida, they've net loss of 210,000 immigrants in the last decade, for example. In Georgia, which we were talking about in a previous broadcast, there's a net loss of 40,000 immigrants there. Mm-hmm. So all of these states, like Arizona, is dramatically down on immigrants. And like to the point that they're down about, I think, 220,000. New Mexico and Colorado are both down about 30,000. Nevada's down 35,000 in the last decade. Mm. The point I'm trying to make here is that immigration is already going down. This is a fear without a purpose.
And by the way, it makes no, you know, you mentioned the 5,000 in North and South Dakota. It makes absolutely no impact there. These are wide open spaces. I don't know where any of these people are or why they are there.
Now, when we talk about the unauthorized immigrants, about 20% are short-term and about 60% are long-term.
Right. And so by short-term, you're actually talking about these border communities like El Paso where people go back and forth during the course of the day.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's about five years or less, those about 20%. So the majority are staying in the United States a long time and contributing to the workforce. Okay. So legislatively, immigration has always been something that's kind of captivated the nation. In Thomas Paine writing in January of 1776, you know, this is an advocate for ending colonialism and independence. He was saying the new America should be limited to just people who come from Europe. And it should just be an asylum for Europeans. And he made that very clear in that. And then in March of 1790, the Naturalization Act only allows for free white persons of good character to be considered U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. The English are the largest ethnic group, obviously, in the United States.
And what constitutes good character? Because, frankly, there were colonies that were established in this country, like Georgia, which were essentially prison colonies.
We're 50,000 convicts made up the founding of Georgia.
I mean, Georgia was like the Australia of America.
Something I'm sure would endear our listeners.
In Australia?
Oh, yeah.
That it was set up as a prison colony?
Yeah.
I'm sure that they embrace that fact, and it's taught in the schools. It should be.
And I wonder if they do that in Georgia.
Guessing not.
No. The first kind of really immigrant fear that we have is in the early 19th century is against the Irish. Mm-hmm. And there's a long-standing hatred between the Irish and the English over the English colonization of the Irish and the demonization of the Irish. And so the Irish were not considered white. They were quickly followed by people freaking out about the Germans as well at that same time. And so we get our first anti-immigrant political party, which are known as the Know Nothing Party or the Loco Focos, who begin arguing for immigration restriction specifically targeted at German and Irish immigrants in the mid-19th century. States began to pass their own immigration laws following the Civil War. In 1875, the Supreme Court declared that it's the responsibility of the federal government, though, to make and enforce the immigration laws, not the states. The Irish will eventually gain their whiteness. They'll be seen as white. Mm-hmm. But the next kind of...
And you know how they did it?
By scapegoating.
Exactly. Absolutely. And you know, this is where you get into the whole stereotype of the Irish policeman who patrols the border lines between black communities and white communities in places like New York or Boston.
Earn your whiteness by being racist.
Right. But that is the formula. That's the formula. You can become white, prove that you're white in the country by rejecting people of color. And the same process for Italians, the same process for Germans, etc. The Irish have forgotten that the early racial formula in this country began with them.
Mm-hmm.
Before English settlers actually got to these shores, their racial formula, in other words, that, you know,
they tested it in Ireland.
Yeah, they tested it in Ireland. So the whole thing was, look, the Irishman is, as you said, is the devil. Sexual mores, religion, drinking habits, social class status, all that were attacked on the Irish. You see that formula being transferred to people of African descent, American Indian descent, then later Asian populations that immigrate here all get that same piece. In fact, I saw a political cartoon from the early 1900s that has a radical Republican, and on top of him are stacked different racial groups on his shoulders. And I believe that there's an Irishman and an Italian in that stack, as well as someone who's black, as well as someone who's Chinese, drawn with the traditional ponytail. But at the very top of the ethnic stack on the Republican shoulders is a monkey, which lets you know how all of those groups are reduced to an animal status.
And so the next, you know, in late 19th century, 1880s, you get massive waves of immigrants. We talked about some of these just now, but Italians, Jews, Chinese, which also sent America wanting to create immigration restriction. And they do. In 1882, they create the Chinese Exclusion Acts, barring the Chinese. 1891, they pass an Immigration Act that excludes immigrants.
You're talking about the Yellow Peril.
Yes.
Yeah, and that the great Jack London, who was embraced all over Oakland, he embraced that, banning people from Asia.
California was the big proponent of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yeah.
And the Immigration Act of 1891, which was passed about 9 years later, it further allowed the United States to bar immigrants, but they also focused on other folks as immigrating, not just people of color from a certain country, but also polygamists, people convicted of certain crimes, and the sick or diseased, which was extended to focus on homosexuals, mm-hmm. were considered sick or diseased. In January of 18...
So then how does Utah exist if you exclude polygamists?
Well, they were allowed to be a state as long as they got rid of it in their legalese. And
to be fair, keep in mind, there was a period in this history where it was perfectly lawful to kill a Mormon.
Yes.
We should be fair about that. At the same time that Mormons were also racist.
In January of 1892, Ellis Island, the United States' first immigration station, opens in New York, where my family went through.
All right.
And the first immigrant there processed is Annie Moore. She was a teenager from County Cork in Ireland. More than 12 million immigrants would enter the United States through Ellis Island.
Do you know the names of your ancestors who came through Ellis Island?
Funny you should bring that up, uh-huh. because my great-grandma went through there with her children, and they gave her a different name, not her actual name. Mm-hmm. And
because they fucked up all the names all the time.
And it was a different age, too. And mm-hmm. So we never really knew her age. And mm-hmm. then I'm always confused as to which name is actually her name.
See, this is the scene that I love the most from the Godfather saga. In Godfather 2, where they show...
that's right. When Vito gets in there as a kid.
Yes, yeah, Vito Andolini from Corleone. So the ignorant processor says, Vito Corleone. Yeah.
One of the Godfathers. My favorite movie.
So immigration peaks again with 1.3 million people entering the country through Ellis Island in 1907. California again leads a racist federal policy against immigrants, this time targeted at the Japanese, with a so-called gentleman's agreement in 1907 to stop Japanese immigration. In 1910, about three-quarters of New York City's population consists of new or first-generation Americans.
Interesting.
Okay, so after World War II, the xenophobia reaches its after World War I, the xenophobia reaches its high. In 1917, the Immigration Act of 1917 is passed. This focuses on non-white countries, majority Asian countries, and again restricts people from having what they see as radical political views, homosexuals, things like that. 1921, 1924, a series of immigration acts are passed that hold restrictions on countries. So a certain percentage of our immigrants can be from each country. White countries are overwhelmingly represented. They account for Great Britain, Ireland, and Germany account for about 70% of the immigrants who are allowed in after 1924.
Isn't this what the dumpster fire has called for, is for greater immigration from, I think his phrase was Scandinavian. I know he doesn't understand anything about geography. Scandinavian countries and not shithole countries?
Yes. You notice a lot of what he says is really in the 20s and 1930s. And I think maybe his parents just told him about the way things were when he was a kid. And that's like his only knowledge of
he's totally
politics.
Bought into it. Yeah. Because his dad was arrested. There's that record of him being arrested at a Klan rally. He is a this is a family that has a record of bigotry.
Took the words out of my mouth. So the Klan reemerges in 1915, and this
with Trump's daddy.
The second Klan is not just a anti-black, pro-South Klan.
Right.
They're a national Klan, and they're now including immigrants as a target.
Jews and Catholics
as well,
which embraces Italians and Irish, right?
And so the U.S. Border Patrol is established in 1924 to crack down on undocumented immigrants, specifically from Mexico and Canada. So 1924 is really the year where this panic sees us put resources on the street.
So you can't come if you're from Canada?
But we like the Canadians.
Only if you have your quota.
And stuff.
They're cute.
It's like a club. There's only so much you can let in at a time.
But to me, this is the most interesting part of immigration is the... It's like an abusive relationship with immigrants that, okay, we hate you, we want you out of here, we're going to block you, and that's 1924. Then during World War II, the economy takes off, we need more resources. Please, let's bring the immigrants in, we need some labor.
I mean, this is, I hope our listeners are getting this. This is key. It's all about the economy. Slavery. One of the things that we never talk about with immigration is that there's no exit strategy. So you bring people here as slaves, and you enslave them to build up the South. They create the South. They also build your infrastructure, your Washington, D.C., the infrastructure of all of your major cities. You have the Bracero program that brings in Mexican labor.
And that's one we're talking about here after World War II. During World War II, excuse me.
But and you invite Chinese immigration in as well. Japanese immigration, all for economic concerns. But then when the economic needs are over with, you want them to go away.
Right.
People don't go away.
So the Bracero program allows Mexican agriculture workers to enter the United States temporarily. The program lasts until 1964. In 1948, the U.S. passes the nation's first refugee and resettlement law to deal with the influx of Europeans seeking permanent residence in the United States after World War II. Again, remember, Europe's destroyed after World War II.
That's
the U.S. is one of the few places that still has a thriving economy. 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act formally ends the exclusion of Asian immigrants to the United States in 1952. Now, in 1956-57, the United States admitted 38,000 immigrants from Hungary after a failed uprising against the Soviets there. The United States would admit 3 million refugees in total during the Cold War. Between 1960 and 62, 14,000 unaccompanied children fleeing Castro's Cuba came to the United States, part of a secret anti-communist program called Operation Peter Pan, which is the dumbest name.
I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so 1965, the quota system ends. So that 1924 quota system I talked about comes to an end in 65. And Lyndon Johnson kind of led the way on that. in October of 1980, or sorry, April to October 1980, roughly 125,000 Cuban refugees make a dangerous sea crossing in overcrowded boats, arrive in Florida seeking political asylum. Okay, so now this idea of amnesty to people who came here undocumented, which the federal government sees a crime. In 1986, Ronald Reagan signed into law the Simpson-Mazzoli Act, which granted amnesty to 3 million immigrants living undocumented or illegally in the United States. In 2001, the Congress proposed the first development, relief, and education for alien minors, DREAM Act, which would provide a pathway to legal status for DREAMers, undocumented immigrants, and their parents. The bill did not pass, and neither did iterations of it. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where things change. Now, that same year is when 9/11 happened. So there's a freak out about many things and about surveillance and security, and the border scene is one of them. So in 2003, ICE is formed, and ICE is a federal law enforcement agency under the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which principally is responsible for immigration enforcement with additional responsibilities countering transnational crime. ICE really sucks at their job. From 2012 to early 2018, they wrongfully arrested and detained almost 1,500 U.S. citizens, including many who spent months or years in immigration detention centers. Mm-hmm. But keeping with this idea of amnesty. So in 2012, President Barack Obama signs DACA, which temporarily shields some DREAMers from deportation, but doesn't provide a pathway to citizenship. Now, when Obama's leaving office, he's very scared of Trump removing DACA. And you can hear him talking about it as he leaves office.
On the deferred action program that we have known as DACA that relates to DREAMers who are currently benefiting from these provisions, I will urge the president-elect and the incoming administration to think long and hard before they are endangering the status of what, for all practical purposes, are American kids.
And so you can hear there that Obama's kind of afraid of his legacy on this because he wasn't able to get it done. But to be fair, you have to remember the kind of things Trump was saying. So here's a video of Trump talking about Mexican people.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
And there you can see Trump is saying they're not sending their best people. And this is what's causing this hysteria. What's this maniac going to do when he's in office? Well, when Trump takes office, he issues two executive orders, both titled Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. And they're aimed at curtailing travel and immigration from six majority Muslim countries, Chad, Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia, as well as North Korea and Venezuela. Both these travel bans end up getting challenged in state and federal courts. Now, in 2017, also ICE, more data comes out about ICE. The Intercept did some great investigative reporting and found that the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General revealed that there were 1,224 sexual abuse complaints while people were in immigration custody between January of 2010 and June of 2017, contrary to ICE's claims that it was only 2%. Contrary to ICE's claims, only 2% were investigated. Mm-hmm. So in 2018, the travel restrictions are kind of lifted, and that's kind of where we're at now with immigration policy. Now, Oxfam has reports that the U.S. is processing very few claims for asylum every day, which leaves more desperate families in limbo. Families and children fleeing violence and poverty continue to come to the border. Without knowing whether or not they're going to be able to get in. Oxfam also says that building a wall is not only expensive, but also ineffective and thus pointless.
AKA dumb.
Yes, and Oxfam's overwhelming investigation says that the people coming to the United States are largely looking for safety and a better life, that there's no evidence of this sort of like threat to our national security.
Well, my understanding is a lot of these people that we're talking about right now on the border who are being detained, particularly these children in cages, are asylum seekers.
Yes. And,
the American public doesn't seem to be sophisticated enough to distinguish between immigration and asylum seeking.
Right, and that's the way Trump has kept this issue off the table, is he's slowed down the processing of asylum.
Right. All you have to do is have more federal judges down there to be able, and courts to be able to process the asylum cases.
So I'm sure listeners have some questions. First, is the U.S.-Mexico border currently closed? No, the border has not been shut down. Could President Trump seal the border if he wished? Yes, although it'd be really difficult, he could do it. He could even do it with a border wall or closing the port, something like that. Now, through the first half of fiscal year 2019, apprehensions in the U.S.-Mexico border have been at their highest level since 2007, with about 361,000 apprehensions. Mm. But again, as I pointed out earlier, a lot of these apprehensions usually pick up the innocent.
Does it strike you that when your president employs ICE to go door-to-door in communities and pull people out and detain them and then have them deported, that, look, I don't want to be hyperbolic here, but it's almost like he's turned ICE into kind of the modern-day version of the SS.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm assuming that SS, I've forgotten sort of that part of my understanding of the Holocaust, if the SS was the force that pulled people out of their homes and put them on the trains to the work camps, or the ghettos first and then the work camps and concentration camps. It was the SS, wasn't it? The
Gestapo SS?
Or was it the Gestapo?
Yeah, I forget.
Okay, but he's essentially turned ICE into that kind of organization.
Yeah, and so the people arrested at the border, I gave that number of 361,000, 53% of them are family units, 10% of them are unaccompanied children, and 38% are single adults. I mean, all the evidence is there that these are people seeking a better life. Now, asylum means asking the U.S. to accept you legally because of persecution you are facing in your home country. Mm-hmm. Now, crossing the border illegally is a misdemeanor for a person who has already been deported once. It's a felony. So the first time you do it, it's a misdemeanor. Second time, it's a felony.
Now, isn't this what was being raised by Julian Castro? Is that, you know, you don't necessarily, his opinion is you don't want this to fall under criminal statute. You want it to fall under civil statute?
Yes, because so seeking asylum obviously is not a crime at all.
No, although it looks like we're making it a crime.
Right. But okay, so authorities at the legal border crossing have been limited to the number of people who can request asylum. So only about 40 to 100 people are allowed each day when we have thousands coming each day.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's down at the border, right? Trump has sent 6,000 troops down to the border to support the Customs and Border Protection. The military police are not supposed to carry out law enforcement duties, but they can protect the Customs and Border Protection officials. So we have militarized the border. It's always ironic to me, these people who supposedly fight for freedom and security are willing to put the military on domestic soil, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Now, the number of Border Patrol agents at the U.S.-Mexico border has actually slightly declined since 2013, from about 18,000 to 16,000. So we're trying to make, it looks like this is becoming more militaristic and less about these domestic security forces. Now, does the military have authorization to use legal force? Trump has said that he's given the okay for them to use legal force, which he's empowered to
do.
Are the numbers of border crossings increasing or at a historic high is probably a question a lot of you have. And the answer is no. Mm-hmm. The total number of migrants apprehended at the border, like I said, is gone up that one year, but it's actually down overall to about 521,000 and remains well below the numbers that were routine in the 1990s and 2000s. So now another interesting point about that too, non-Mexicans now outnumber Mexicans in southwestern border apprehensions. So, say that again.
Yeah, I'm just like marveling about some of these statistics that are bringing out the real truth of what's going on at the border for us.
Yeah, in about 2018, roughly about 152,000 people from the nation of Mexico were apprehended at the border.
Yeah.
But it was nearly 300,000 of people from non-Mexican nations.
Yeah, I don't think that people understand that this also includes new African immigrants. This includes immigrants from what we unfortunately call the Middle East. It affects Dominican
A lot of folks from Guatemala.
A lot of folks from Guatemala, all these other places. And interestingly enough, a lot of people from places where our own federal interventionist policy screwed up their communities.
Yeah, like in Mexico, for example, we militarized the government to go after the drug war. Instead, these folks ended up setting shop in the United States, getting U.S. weapons, which were affordable. Yeah. We talked about that on our mass shooting show a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And now you have basically a war in the nation of Mexico, and people trying to flee that war to get safety and security for their families are being arrested at the border. Okay, so Trump wanted to do tougher conditions, and specifically his administration interpreted Section 13.25 of Title 8 of the Code of Laws of the United States, that's the body of the federal law dealing with immigration and nationality, to allow harsher enforcement mechanisms. And so he's allowed for this so-called zero policy approach, which he talks about. Now, it's worth noting that a lot of cities responded with what they called sanctuary cities, that they were going to try and,
right.
And not just cities too, but like counties, states as well, like Colorado, California, Oregon, Illinois. They've gotten on board with this as well. But yeah, as a way to get around his zero policy or zero tolerance policy. Now, in June of 2018, it emerged that the policy did not include measures to reunite the families that had separated. From July to October 2017, the Trump administration ran what the DHS called a pilot program for zero tolerance in El Paso. Families were separated, including families that were seeking asylum, and children were then reclassified as unaccompanied. So these people seeking asylum, doing it legally, were still separated, and then their kids were reclassified as unaccompanied.
Yeah, that's problematic. I mean, he's weaponized the entire immigration system.
So Trump, in June of 2018, responded to pressure and signed an executive order to end family separation of the border. However, since June of 2018, hundreds of additional children have been separated from their parents. In March 2019, the government reported to a judge that since the time of the executive order, 245 children had been removed from their families, at least that was known. A House Committee on Oversight Reform in July of 2019 found that over 700 children had been separated from their families. And some estimates have it as many as 5 children a day are separated from their families. Now, Trump, he did the honest thing, and he took responsibility for it.
Oh, naturally.
I made that up. Okay, now, he blamed Obama. He blames Obama and the Democrats.
Obama started the cages and things like that.
Right, and that's absolutely false. It's been proven false time and time again. Yeah. But nonetheless, under Trump, at least 2,800 family reunifications did take place, which means there were at least 2,800 separations.
But to be fair to Schittler, he has taken responsibility implicitly for the cruelty. And, you know, look, I read an article about this that was actually entitled, you know, "The Cruelty is the Point." And I agree with that. That is the point. You know, a lot of us are appalled by seeing these children in cages, hearing about people who have to drink out of toilets to have, you know, water, or the images of adults also crowded into these cages, one on top of the other. But the fact is that is the point. Like, I often used to wonder why the Nazis took film of concentration camps. What was the point of that? And there was also film, obviously, that was taken when they liberated, when those concentration camps were liberated by American and Russian forces coming from Germany on both ends, from the east and from the west. But why did the Germans take pictures of this or take film of it? It's because cruelty is the point. That is what it is about. And ultimately, for people who support this kind of policy, I'm going to say something a little controversial here. I don't think that seeing images of children separated from their families moves them to change their minds. Mm-hmm. I think it cements in their heads, yeah, we're doing the right thing. Trump is for me. He's maintaining a white America.
Yeah, and so let's talk about these cages. So they've been described as wire mesh, chain-linked cages that are about 30 by 30 feet with, quote, a lot of young folks put in them. About 30 members of Congress actually went down to visit these cages, and as did reporters. The AP reported that, quote, one cage had 20 children inside, scattered about are bottles of water, bags of chips, and large foil sheets intended to serve as blankets. Representative Brenda Lawrence of Detroit, Michigan, for some reason, I read a lot of these quotes. It's one of those powerful ones to me. She said, "I saw exhaustion. They don't know what's going to happen next. They are children, and they're just lying around with no emotion. How do you get a cage full of children from 5 to 8 years old, and there's no activity, there's no laughter, they're held in a cage?"
Right, they're being tortured, essentially. And what's so screwed up about this is if they ever get back to their parents, a lot of these kids are so young that you keep them away from their parents long enough, they don't really recognize their parents. So there are, my understanding is that there are also adoptions that get set up through this, too, where you can come down and you can get yourself a Central American baby, kind of just, you know, go shopping.
Legacy of trauma. So
absolutely,
it just becomes a crime of crime against humanity.
It is a crime against humanity.
So, okay, so when you bring that up, this was one of the points that Representative AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, raised about the. She called these detention centers concentration camps. She said 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. So she called them concentration camps, and in response, the Republican Jewish Coalition signed a statement that said 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. It is disgraceful for Representative Ocasio-Cortez to compare our nation's immigration policies to the horrors carried out by the Nazis. This was echoed by Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming.
She's not unbiased. That's right.
Yeah. Ocasio-Cortez said, responding to Cortez, saying, "Do us all a favor and spend just a few minutes learning some actual history. 6 million Jews were exterminated in the Holocaust. You demean their memory and disgrace yourself with comments like this." What was interesting to me is that they jumped into the Holocaust because they knew they couldn't win the concentration camps argument. Concentration camps, yes, are a part of the Holocaust,
but
the concentration camps are not just the Holocaust. Holocaust isn't simply just concentration camps.
Yeah.
So, Ocasio-Cortez responded, "Hey, Representative Cheney, since you're so eager to educate me, I'm curious, what do you call building mass camps of people being detained without a trial? How would you dress up a Department of Homeland Security's mass separation of thousands of centers, cages of children, etc.?" So, the liberal Jewish group backed Ocasio-Cortez. They believe the comparison was accurate.
Yeah, they're right.
Yeah. And then Andrea Pitzer, the author of One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps, claims that they are concentration camps, noting, quote, "And the detention of that in my, the definition of that in my book is mass detention of civilians without trial. That's a concentration camp."
You know, that whole debate, by the way, about can you analogize to concentration camps during Nazi Germany is predicated on, well, I think, one of the worst debates that you can have, which is the debate of who's more oppressed.
The oppression Olympics.
And essentially what you hear people who are pushing back against that analogy are saying is that if you suffer through the Jewish Holocaust, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. And there have been long debates between African Americans and Jewish Americans about whose Holocaust is worse.
Yeah, so,
but here's the thing I do want to say before I stop. Nolan, that's a losing battle.
Oh, fighting against each other, absolutely.
You don't win the battle of who's a bigger victim.
Yeah.
We're all boned, okay? What you need to build out of that is a space of coalition. So, if I'm an African American, if I'm a Jewish American, if I'm a Japanese American, if I'm any group that has suffered under American immigration policy at any point in time in American history, I need to be in solidarity with those people at the border, period. I'm not interested in comparing whether my situation is worse than theirs. Oh, all they had to do is drink out of toilets, but we suffered under the lash for 400 years. That's a bullshit discussion.
Yeah, so in Waitman Wade Buron, he's a Holocaust and Genocide Studies historian at University of Virginia, would agree with you. He said, quote, "What's required is a little bit of demystification. Things can be concentration camps without being Auschwitz. Concentration camps in general have always been designed at the most basic level to separate one group of people from another group, usually because the majority group or the creators of the camp deem the people they're putting in it to be dangerous or undesirable in some way." Mm-hmm. So I think Ocasio-Cortez was well grounded in the concentration camps.
She's actually historically rooted. The Nazi concentration camp is actually built off of the model of the American reservation. It has a history itself. So, you know, would it have been improper in Nazi Germany to have said, oh, these camps are just like reservations in America? No, it would not have been improper. It would have been historically correct. And once again, you're not going to compare American Indian genocide with the Nazi Holocaust. Both of them are fucked up human rights violations, and everybody needs to be in, everybody who suffered in that needs to be in solidarity, as well as those people who feel ashamed of their own country's histories in putting that together.
And so Trump said that his whole purpose in this was he was going to force a crisis at the border so they could finally get immigration policy passed. We have a video of that.
And I'll say it very honestly, and I'll say it very straight. Immigration is the fault and all of the problems that we're having, because we cannot get them to sign legislation. We cannot get them even to the negotiating table. And I say it's very strongly the Democrats' fault.
Crisis created. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, it's the Democrats say that Trump will not come to the negotiating table. Trump blames the Democrats for not negotiating with them. And now in April of 2019, Trump says he's strongly looking at a plan to send all captured immigrants to sanctuary cities. Where I think we are here is an interesting moment. We've needed legislation for quite some time. That's why we went over the history here today. Mm-hmm. I do have to say, I think this issue of immigration, much like guns, is a great wedge issue that both sides, I really don't think, want to get rid of. I think there are people on both sides who believe what they say. There's people who do want to lock up kids in cages. There are people who want legal pathway to immigration. But I think there's a lot of them who just love this, because one of the fastest growing demographics in this country continues to be Latinx folks. Right. One of the major issues in that community is immigration, and it serves well to get voters out for either side.
Absolutely. They're going to come out, but their vote's also going to be repressed in the 2020 election. They're going to do everything that they can, especially in Republican-controlled states where you have a governor who's appointed a commissioner of elections or whatever the title may be, they're going to suppress votes for Latinx folks. I think you're right. I think that the shit show on the border is not about policy. It's about the shit show on the border, okay, and the rallies and people, you know, you at a recent rally, you know, Trump is talking about these folks and someone yells out, what are you going to do with them, he asks. And then someone yells out, shoot them. And you see that smile on his face. You know that this is about the shit show. And his belief that that will solidify his white supremacist and white supremacist sympathizing base.
And we'll continue to talk about this issue and other issues on the 2020 campaign. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. You've been listening to Along the Line, brought to you by the Media Freedom Foundation. My co-hosts, as always, are Dr. Dreadlocks, Nicholas Bayham III, our editor and sound engineer, the great JD, Janice Domingo. Mickey Huff is our producer. Adam Armstrong is our webmaster. Listen to all of our previous content at projectcensor.org/ATL, youtube.com/alongtheline. Contact us on Twitter at Nolan_Higdon. Nick is at Dr. Dreadlocks. And Janice is at J_Nice44. You listen responsibly. Smiling back at me. I'm